What you've just seen is a terrific presentation from one of the fastest forming and most effective community groups in 30 years of working in the environment at all different levels, citizen, expert, government, I've ever seen. And there is a message that... And theirs is a message you should heed. Now, I get to kind of come last and add a few accents. And the first accent I want to talk about is that number of 40,000 wells in New York and then the infill, and the number of 80,000 wells in Pennsylvania. Now, these numbers bring gleams to the eyes of government budget officials. That is, there are these pictures of a golden flow of wealth coming across the landscape. On the other hand, the same people who are promising this golden flow of wealth, when you ask them, well, how about sharing a little of that with the third parties you're impacting? How about mitigating? Suddenly, they are dirt poor. Suddenly, they have to dispose of their fracking material by pouring it on roads. Suddenly, they are threatening you, we're going to move out of the state because this is overregulation. One of those pictures is wrong. That is, we are talking about an industry that has hundreds of billions of dollars of income a year. It can afford to do it right. And what I want to talk about tonight is not the question of in the absolute, is whether it's all an all or nothing business in natural gas extraction. What I want to talk about is what it would take to do it right. And what it would take to do it right is in a context of basically, good housekeeping. Let me talk to you about why we get all of these environmental problems with natural gas drilling right now. Originally, natural gas drilling was a fairly benign thing. It was either a byproduct of oil production, which meant that the environmental damage had already been done, or it was essentially an extraction out of dome deposits of fuel. Fracking changed all of that. Fracking changed clean-burning natural gas from clean-burning but awfully dirty extracting natural gas. Because currently under the processes we use to extract this natural gas, there's five ways to trash the environment. One is the fracking material gets left in the ground. And as Barbara suggested, it migrates. Now, there's an argument made that the Marcellus Shale is so far below the water aquifers that that's okay, that it's never going to get up thousands of feet and pollute those aquifers. Of course, that depends on three things. It first depends on the fact that your concrete casings don't fail. In the private sector, when you pour concrete, you almost always have an independent safety inspector to do it. That's the role that should be played by the Department of Environmental Conservation in New York and the Department of Environmental Protection in Jersey. That role is not played. You heard Barbara talk about the facts of casing failure. Just one can be catastrophic. The second way this can trash the environment is through surface eruption. That is, as you heard, these systems are under pressure. This pressure is explosive. It has to be released. When it's released, that release is essentially, under current technology, uncontrollable. The third is lagoon storage. Lagoon storage is subject to seepage into the groundwater, and then it does go down to the aquifer layers. It can be swept into streams by flooding, and it can go into other places. The fourth is just spills. Gas and oil have traditionally been a messy industry. They've been a messy industry because they have generated so much money, regulators have given them a very light hand. And the fifth way is the sheer scale of the land clearing that is involved. I mean, if the industry were to get just the 40,000 wells of its initial desire, that's 200,000 acres of land that gets cleared in this checkerboard pattern. If it were to then to do the infilling that you heard Joe describe, you would get even tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of more acres. Your landscape would be industrialized. You must understand that this is the biggest thing that is going to hit the Northeast landscape since strip mining you know, came of age in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And if you've been around places in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Kentucky, and West Virginia that have had large-scale strip mining, it's not, what did they like to say in some of those Walt Disney movies? It's not a pretty sight. They said that? It really is not a very pretty sight at all. Now, what does this mean for you? It's going to mean, first of all, the infrastructure agriculture business is going to be undercut. It's going to mean your recreation business, that the attractiveness of this area for tourism is going to be gone. It is going to mean the quality of life will suffer. Did you hear the noise? Did you see the lights? Did you talk about the odors? Did you look at the public health things? It's going to mean that the roads will be congested. It's going to mean there will be new pipelines fragmenting land. And it is going to mean that there are going to be lots of fights with landowners. There are going to be lots of fights with landowners who sell versus landowners who don't. And there are going to be lots of fights with landowners who find out that their deals with the gas companies turn out to be something far different than they expected. If you look carefully at Barbara's last slide about the distribution of natural gas, what you would have seen is the little line that said, had to pay $360 million in missing royalties that were not paid over properly because people had to fight them. The federal government has gone through period after period with the petroleum industry about trying to collect royalties that were due for gas production on federal land. There's one of the problems I have with the Marcellus shale gas drilling, with the whole problem of hydrofracking as a technology, is it runs against one of my favorite sayings, which are things that are too good to be true usually are. And that's something that has to be dealt with very carefully. Now, Wyoming. And if you think some of this is exaggerated, have any of you ever been to Wyoming? You know, Wyoming is one of the emptiest places in the United States. In the southwest corner of Wyoming, is one of the emptiest places in Wyoming. That area is now an ozone non-attainment area, exactly like Los Angeles, solely because of the ozone emissions that have come from natural gas production. And that the Republican governor of Wyoming, traditionally a friend of the natural gas industry, has now asked for federal help in addressing this problem. So, you heard about water in the Northeast. You heard about global warming, you know, that, well, this is an area that's full of water. Let me introduce a concept that should touch on this two or three things. It is called global warming. Now, one of the things we know about global warming is that it's going to mean less water. Because even in areas where global warming means more rain, the evaporation from the heat and the loss of snow cover in the winter are going to mean that water supplies are going to be increasingly stressed. I'm doing some significant work in California for the Forest Service right now, and they are about to lose 50,000 agricultural jobs this summer because of the impact of drought in the California Central Valley. So that to come in and say, well, there's plenty of water here and we don't really have to worry about regulating or thinking about it or using it, that does not look like a very realistic view of the future. And that's assume you don't pollute any water. But as you've heard, we could lose lots of water under the current practices that the industry is engaging in. And if you combine the loss of water from natural causes, the use of water for this industry, and the pollution of water, that this area, which has traditionally been water-rich, could suddenly find itself in a surprisingly uncomfortable position. Global warming. Speaking of global warming, let's talk about those 6,000 drilling rigs that are going to be here 50 years from now. If there are 6,000 drilling rigs here 50 years from now, I hope you're planning to walk around wearing swimsuits, because that's what the temperature is going to be like from global warming. That essentially, I don't know if any of you saw the press release on this, the latest study has just shown that the oceans are rising twice as fast as previously predicted. If there's a thing to be scared about global warming, It is the fact that every time they study something, they find out that what they predicted would happen in 2020 is happening now, or what they predicted would start about 2030 has already started now. That we are looking at transforming an entire global. We have become, with global warming, a geological force, and not for the better. The oceans are acidifying. The ocean temperatures are going up. Before we decide that this natural gas is worth essentially the subsidy of environmental pollution, for that's what environmental pollution really is, it's a subsidy, then we ought to think about what it means for the future of this county, the state, this country, this planet. The reason people now run ads about our corporation is green, the reason people talk about concepts about sustainability, the reason people have come, however imperfectly, however vaguely, to understand that we have to make the environment and the economy run together is because they've seen one too many pictures of the Arctic Ocean melting, because they've seen one too many pictures of giant forest fires in California or hurricanes hitting the coast or people dying of heat in France or monsoon rain patterns totally changing in Southeast Asia. Do we really want to subsidize a fuel that, while being better than oil and coal, although by much less a margin than has traditionally been believed because of that total accounting Barbara talked about, that is essentially planning our own destruction? There is perhaps an interim use for natural gas as we go down the road, but the future is in renewable energy. Speaking of which, any of you who have looked at your utility bills know that you are paying a fee every month in this state to subsidize the introduction of renewable energy into this state. Think for a minute if you are going to subsidize natural gas pollution by under-regulating it, by allowing it to get away with this environmental damage, what you have just done. You've essentially said, we're going to spend $1 billion on renewable energy, and then I'm told I must stop tapping on the podium, okay? let me try and remove myself from temptation. These topics get more than a little heated, if I may use a bad metaphor. Think about what you're doing. You're spending $1 billion in your utility bills to try and develop wind power, solar power, energy conservation, geothermal, low-head hydro. And then at the same time, by under-regulating natural gas as a boiler fuel, you are competing against your own investment. If there's a place for natural gas, and there is one, it nevertheless has to be a place that is chosen by natural gas paying the true cost of its production. And that, incidentally, is a free market principle. Beyond the conflict of being between we're very rich, we're very poor, nothing amuses me more in environmental debate than hear people argue against environmental regulation on free market grounds. Well, a true free market only takes place when you internalize all your costs of production. Otherwise, it is a subsidy that is only different in form from those given to some notorious companies, first acronym letter A, last letter G. It's exactly the same kind of foolish policy, and it's exactly the kind of policy that encourages waste, misuse of resources, and ultimately crashes and burns. And that's what's at stake here. The long-term future of the world is in developing our renewable energy resources as fast as possible. The long-term future of the world is in understanding that that is the way to get cheaper energy and better energy, and that we have lived long enough in a society where we subsidize the consumption of fuels that are essentially have turned something that was once very good into something very bad. Now, I want to talk about then what the natural gas industry should do. Because the natural gas industry is currently going around and blaming, you know, people like Joe and Barbara for trying to get their industry overregulated, they really have their fate in their own hands. And the fate that they have should be turned around by the word sustainability. That is, the natural gas industry can afford to do these extraction things right. And what do I mean by doing it right? Well, doing it right means paying true costs in a variety of ways. And a lot of people, and I hope there will be people from Ithaca and political leaders from Ithaca will join this, are looking forward to getting the New York State Legislature to essentially set a set of standards for how this industry should proceed. And the first set of standards has to be that in all of the areas that are significant for water supply, including like the sole source aquifer for Binghamton, in all the areas that have unique natural resources or support a flourishing agricultural economy, are significant for local recreation and tourism, those areas have to be off limits for drilling. Now, have we just doomed this industry to economic failure? Have we just frozen everyone out? No. You heard the numbers Joe said about the size of the Marcellus Shale. This is an industry that can afford to leave the significant areas of impact on the table, to concentrate on areas where, with the proper safeguards, they can actually drill this thing without significant environmental, social, and local economic impact. And any other statement to the contrary is essentially just an expression of a Wild West mentality. And I use that deliberately, because currently, thanks to our late and unlamented, at least from my perspective, former Vice President Mr. Cheney, natural gas extraction has less regulation on it than if you put a septic system next to a stream in your own backyard, which does not make an enormous amount of sense. If you use all the chemicals Barbara was talking about for any other purpose but natural gas extraction, they're hazardous waste. They are recognized for what they are, significant health hazards that have to be controlled and managed. The operative word here is cradle to grave. But somehow, for natural gas, none of this stuff matters. There's no logic to that, and I am relatively confident that within the next year, the federal government is going to realize that and is going to change. But there's no law that says that you can't, through pushing your representatives, help this process of change along. The second thing that needs to be in the framework of planning whatever natural gas extraction makes sense is enforcement. I was one of the people who helped organize the New York City Watershed Program, and I take a great pride in that work. In 3 years, I hired over 400 people, new people, to do all the aspects of the Watershed Program. This was for an area 10% the size of potential drilling for the Marcellus Shale, and for a problem that is ultimately less complex, because it does not have all of the underground difficulties and management of this problem. Does that mean DEC should hire 4,000 people? No, but it means it should hire an awful lot of them. And how can they afford that in a time that the state has a $14 billion budget deficit? Simple. Fees on the natural gas industry and natural gas extraction. That's part of their cost of doing business. Whether it's the safety inspectors to deal with the casings, whether it's the unannounced visits to see if there have been spills in the ground that have been buried, whether it's the planning the paperwork to make sure all of the planning is going, whether it's responding to citizen complaints because suddenly they can't drink the water in their well. If we're going to have natural gas extraction that you can live with, then we have to have an environmental agency that you can trust and that you can rely on to do the job. The third thing is the local government has to have a major role in this. Even if you want technology standards that are uniform across the state, there are a huge number of local impacts that are going to take place. This drilling must be done in ways that are consistent with zoning, that work with local government to minimize the impacts, that does not run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with noise and plumes and lights that anyone who lives within half a mile or more is going to never find their life to be the same kind of thing again. Local government has to have the authority and the resources and be entitled to levy mitigation fees on these operations to ensure that they are consistent with the local economy and that they are consistent with the expectations of their citizens to quiet enjoyment of their life. Property values. Let's talk about property values for a minute. Clearly, there are a lot of landowners who would like to take advantage of what they see as an opportunity to lift themselves up economically. But the balancing problem has to be that if you're not one of those landowners who is in the pool, then you are very likely in this landscape going to find yourself, as they have found in these states, selling your cattle, moving your business, finding that your property is unable, to be marketable in any kind of way that it was in the past. This is the kind of planning dilemma that a three-month hastily wrought up, which many of us have begun to fear is the kind of EIS DEC is going to be doing, is not going to address. And this is an issue that has to be addressed. And if the administrative system won't address it and come up with a solution that is fair to both sides, then the political system has to address it. And you have to be part of the process of making the political system address it. As I said, the challenge of the future, if we're going to get out of the messes of global warming and water shortages and of the extreme cost, we have to make the environment and the economy work together. That is the challenge the natural gas industry faces. That is the challenge we all face because basically in the 50 years looking forward to the future, I don't see 6,000 wells here. I see no wells. I see an economy that 50 years from now, the only thing we burn hydrocarbons for is for jet fuel because we don't have a way of getting windmills up on jet planes yet. But basically, whether we like it or not, humanity has come to the end of the road using carbon combustion as its main source of energy. But is there a place for natural gas in the next 15 to 20 years to make that transition? Yes. But it's only a place if they pay the true price of their production, if they integrate their operations with economic, social, and environmental factors, and if they submit to a whole new set of sustainable standards. I don't want to check the entire list off tonight, but I just want to mention two other things that I think are of particular interest for landowners, whether you are thinking of leasing or not. The first thing is we need legislation in this state and in Pennsylvania that gives the state controllers authority to annually audit all royalty payments to make sure that if you do sign up, you get what you signed up for. And that we further need authority so that the plans of these companies will be disclosed in advance. We just saw a story from Pennsylvania where an individual, under what appear to be certain ambiguous assurances, leased his property. He woke up one morning and found that they were about to take a road over his best pasture and put the drilling pad on top of the place he ultimately planned to build his retirement home. That gentleman would now like to be out of that lease, but it is too late. There are lots of issues in places like Dimrock, where the wells have been contaminated, coincidentally, only after gas drilling happened. The gas companies say, you prove it is our fault. We need legal standards in which the gas companies have to prove it wasn't their fault before this damage is done. And if I play the lawyer for a second, by clear and convincing evidence. The other thing I want to talk about is Some of you probably understand the pooling process, where if you're a landowner in a large group and you've decided for whatever reason you don't want to lease, you can be forced to open your land to gas drilling. And what you get paid is the lowest price any other landowner has been given. This provision was designed to force landowners to bargain with the natural gas industry. Back at a time when natural gas was a much simpler, much more benign extraction process, and it was thought to be a good thing for the rural economy. At the very least, people who are forced into pools should get the highest price given to any other member of the pool. Because in fairness, if they have reasons for not wanting to lease and are forced to lease, they should not have to take the leavings. They should at least get the top dollar that someone else is getting. There's going to be a legislative process in the legislature over the next year. Jim Brennan of the Brooklyn Assemblyman who's long been sensitive to these issues, are going to drive it. But if it's going to be a success, if we're going to deal with these issues, we need a statewide process. We need a statewide coalition. Joe and Barbara are here to talk to you about how to do that. Wes Gillingham, Riverkeeper, is also here. I'm proud to be associated with these people, even though my community organizing days are mostly over, but I do like to do a little rabble-rousing from time to time. And so I want to close by giving you kind of a cue to how this debate is going to go forward. There's a lawyer's lore that says if you are defending a man charged with murder, you say three things. He didn't do it. It's self-defense. And the bastard deserved to die. Now, in environmental debate, if you hone your ear, you'll hear exactly the same thing. This won't harm the environment at all. Or, well, and even if it harms the environment, well, we've got to do it. Because the economic benefits are so big that we will go back to the Stone Age if we don't make this kind of thing. And then they lose that argument. And besides, the people who are opposing us aren't for energy independence. They're eco-freaks. They care more about animals than people. They don't understand landowner rights. They're just a bunch of cruds who want you to freeze in the dark. And that third argument is what we are going to get, because we are winning the argument on, one, that this is environmentally risky, and two, except if you're an energy company, with close ties to Halliburton, it's in no one's economic benefit to be doing this. So three, we're going to increasingly see this get down and dirty and personal. And what we really need is not a down and dirty and personal argument by an industry that is trying to establish that however much environmental damage they do, it's acceptable. What we need is a collaboration between industry and us to find a way to do this in a sustainable, harmless way, to find fracking fluids that are biodegradable, to find operating procedures that are spill-proof, to find operating activities that are quiet, that the neighbors can live with, to strike a balance of fairness between the landowners who want to extract and the landowners who don't, and to ensure that the rural economy grows and not suffers from these kinds of activities. This is not your problem. This is the natural gas industry's problem. And if they refuse to rise to this challenge, then I predict that they will not have 3,000, 6,000 wells. They will be lucky to have 6. Thank you, everyone.
Al Appleton, international expert on sustainable development and water resource management.
There's going to be a May 6th forum at the Women's Community Building entitled Gas Drilling, What Towns Can Do. And one of the speakers that is going to be presenting there is Dr. Steve Penningroth, who is director of the Community Science Institute, which is a not-for-profit organization which does water quality monitoring of streams and of Cayuga Lake. Their mission is to protect water resources in partnership with citizen volunteers. So I wanted to introduce Dr. Steve Penningroth, if he's in the audience, and allow him an opportunity to say a couple things.
Thank you. I think this is a terrific forum. It's very educational, very informative. And what I have done is prepare a handout, a two-page handout. It's around here somewhere. And that's a short version of a longer handout, frequently asked questions about what you can do to detect and document a contamination of your well water or your stream water, your pond water, by gas well activity. And a lot of people have asked me about this. I've gotten interested in it. I'm the director of a certified water quality testing lab here in Tompkins County. We're actually the largest lab in the county in terms of the number of different analytes that we test for. So I looked at this as kind of a challenge, you know, because so little is known about the specific chemicals that go into fracking fluid. How can you possibly, as Theo Colburn said, how can you possibly test for things that you don't know whether they are there or not? And the answer is you can't test for all of them. There's a lot of them that you cannot test for, but there are some that you can test for because they are characteristic of the chemicals that are used in drilling fluids and in fracking fluids and that come out of the ground. And these are things like salt and turbidity and chloride and sulfate and metals and radioactive materials and methane. All of those things can be tested for. So what I suggest in that handout is that people, if they're interested in testing their water, that they do so, that they get a baseline test done before the well goes in and then test again after the well goes in, and then every couple of years after that.
It was in the paper.
Okay.
You guys allowed, you know, water from the company to go into their water stream, and they don't want to disclose what the chemicals were. And this gentleman is saying you can't, you know, deal with all of them. So I think that's something that we all should be concerned about, because that's where it starts. It starts by saying no. Okay? It starts by saying no. And I would like the state, I would like for people who lease their land, who don't know what they were getting into, to be able to unlease it. That's where the power lies.
Faye, I agree with everything you said, I believe. But let's move it along. Dr. Penningroth, there's one question that I have. Is there a place online that individuals can get this fact sheet that you mentioned is circulating out here now?
Yes, it'll be at www.communityscience.org, and hopefully within a couple of weeks.
There is also a citizen's petition, which is available for you to sign. I guess I have one of the copies of it. That petition asks the DEC to consider hearings on the final supplemental generic environmental impact statement on gas drilling instead of the usual simple 30-day written comment period. Fourth, as Mr. Appleton indicated, one of the things you might think of doing is contacting your representatives and letting them know how you feel. First person at the microphone, you're on.
First of all, I wanted to thank our guests from Damascus Citizens for traveling all the way up here and sharing their information and slides and movie with us, and just express a comment that, going back to that film clip we saw, I've seen that a number of times, and every time it hits me like a rock in the stomach, and just emphasizes for me the fact that these companies do not care about us, they do not care about their impacts, and they will get away with anything that they can, absolutely anything that they can. And I basically feel like they are declaring war on us. In that context, my question, when these companies are doing these kinds of things all around the world, the company that is operating in our area, Fortuna, is owned by Talisman, which is tied with genocide in Sudan, where it had armed troops guarding their oil fields and committing genocide for the extraction process. These are companies that will do anything for this. In that kind of context, where this is what we're facing, and this is a question for the third speaker, how can you talk about it in this kind of way, like everything can just be okay, that we can just lobby our government and pass some kind of regulation and have some kind of way that we can just work together with the industry for these kinds of examples of these idealized situations which do not exist. Those technologies do not exist, and those companies will not employ them. And how can we get back to that kind of place of we are under threat for our lives, our lives, our children's lives, the future of this land we hold dear, and we are not going to wait around for some legislators to pass some kind of weak laws which won't even be enforced in the first place to hope for some kind of technology that doesn't exist out there. We need to get together with each other, and we need to fight this, and we cannot trust the people who are just going to facilitate this process along. And the DEC has already put out their scoping document, and these things are not included in it. This is not the process. So how can you tell us that this is what we need to do when that's not going to happen, and we need to be realistic about that?
Well, realism takes many shapes. Basically, as I have said to the media before this presentation this evening, the industry is not up to doing that. They shouldn't be allowed to drill. But basically, human life advances by trying to persuade bad people to become good people. As I said, it's up to them.
Mr. Appleton, you said you like to rabble rouse. Can I do it for a second? Toward you?
To him, he's
okay. All right. The flyer for this meeting has an inaccurate statement, I believe, in it. It says that you designed and initiated the world-renowned Catskill Watershed Protection Program. You were out of that office in 1993, and to use legal terms, the MOA was signed in 1997. What happened to Marilyn Gilber?
As I was saying about step three, the first... But I'll give 15 seconds.
All right, real quick. Okay, thank you.
The first FAD was signed by the state in November of 1991, the second by EPA in November of 1993. The whole farm agreement was signed in 1991. The 400 people were carried on, by which I did this, and Maryland carried on what I did. End of story.
Okay, thanks. Somebody said irrelevant over there? Well, let me tell you something. This is the stuff from Albany.
Right.
He's got a lot of credits, of credits about his policies in the Delaware County watershed. I think you ought to research it before you make a statement like this that could be inaccurate.
Okay, thank you. Next question, please try to limit it to a question. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm interested in the potential role of the federal government to any of the speakers. Have they weighed in on this issue? Are they a potential ally in this not turning into the Wild West? And also, can that provision in the 2005 Energy Act that seems just very destructive about making the wastewater not be a hazardous material, can that be reversed?
The federal government is in flux at the moment. Exemptions to the regulatory structure were put in previous to the 2005 Energy Bill, and a number of them in the 2005 Energy Bill. These exemptions for the gas and oil industry must be reversed. They are part of the externalization of the environmental costs that weigh to the community instead of to the industry and the cost of gas itself. And this, you must let your elected officials know what your opinions are. In Colorado, they threw out all the people who were facilitating the gas drilling in Colorado. This is what should happen everywhere.
I'd like to give people what I believe is an important heads up about what's also driving this project into the northeast of the Marcellus Shale, and that is the marriage with the gas industry and the clean coal industry in the future carbon sequestration. It's going to be, as they're capping wells out west with the low natural gas prices, they're proceeding with the Marcellus while they can exploit this 2005 exemption, because once they are able to build this infrastructure, this will be the perfect facility as the shale peters out for them to use to carbon sequest into the shale formation. That's a big thing that's driving this whole project that has been totally off the radar, and people's leases need to be aware of that keenly, that for there to be storage. And we need to immediately also...
Thank you. Next question, please.
Yeah.
I wish we could have heard the rest of that. Al, you had said we need to find safer ways to do this. We need to find cleaner ways to do this. We need to find the right way to do that. I'm incredibly skeptical that those ways exist. I guess I would ask, So where is this right way supposedly going to happen? Is it going to happen in the most economically stressed areas? Is it going to happen in Van Etten, for instance, as opposed to the New York City watershed? Is it going to happen in Spencer, for instance, rather than the Ithaca area? Is it going to happen basically where poor people live? Is that kind of where, like, the appropriate place to drill really means? And then my other question is for everybody here. There's a lot of talk about talking to your legislators and elected officials, and I want to pose a question to you. I want everybody here to go home and look yourself in the mirror, and I want you to ask, not like who, what elected official can I wait around for, but I want you to look at yourself and look at your kids and look out the window at the land, and I want you to say, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? Do I need to learn community organizing skills? Do I need to learn how to test water myself? Do I need to? You need to do it. And so that's what I want to leave. I want to leave that. Will you do that?
Let me put it to the first question, because the second was just kind of another good rabble-rousing statement. To the first question, I don't actually know all the answers to what it would take to do this right, but I just know that right now we're doing it wrong. And that until you sort out all of those answers, then you cannot claim that this is a good idea. There's a couple of one thing I want to mention quickly, two very quick things. First of all, I've heard a certain amount of cynicism tonight, and God knows there's lots of reasons in this country to be cynical. But my friend over there, to the contrary, about my role in the watershed, when I started the watershed program, nobody said something like this could be done. When I started the program to save 400 million gallons a day of water in New York City, no one said it could be done. When we started the program in China to change the way Shanghai did its water rates to help poor people, no one said it can be done. As long as you say it can't be done, it can't be done. But until you try it, you won't know if it will be done. I don't know what the right siting paradigm is. All I know is the way we're going about it is the wrong one. But unless you want to say no natural gas drilling, which is a perfectly reasonable position, and I'm perfectly prepared to say 20 years from now we should be out of this business because we should be out of all hydrocarbon business, you can at least say no natural gas drilling unless.
I just wanted to suggest the idea of when we all go home over the next couple of weeks to sort of sort out where and how much natural gas we use in our daily lives, from the manufactured goods that we're buying and residential energy, and especially in the food that we're eating, just kind of get a sense of what kind of demand that we as a group are putting out there to the rest of the world for all this action to take place. Just that's it.
This is a very good point, especially since there's been studies done that we could easily save 30% of our total energy usage at this moment. That 30% would more than cover all of the drilling that's planned.
Thank you for being here. Every single one of these meetings is extremely informative. My husband and I have been attending them for 12 years. Not much has changed in fairness to the landowner or honesty among this industry and the people who represent this industry. We're farm people. We need water to help feed people. Our very basic resource is one that is so extremely highly valued. Once we lose it, it's not coming back. So all of us together need to fight for this. To do this successfully, it means contacting our politicians from a local level to the federal level. We can do this if we stick together. It's worth fighting for. Thank you.
I would like to add one accent to that comment. You always remember afterwards the one thing you wanted to say and forgot to. What makes these fracking compounds so dangerous? The comment about it not coming back. These things don't biodegrade. No tapping, I'm sorry. These things do. Once they're in the environment, they're in the environment virtually forever. The only way to protect the environment from these compounds is to keep them out.
Hi, Mr. Appleton. I have a question for you, please. I understand that the whole process of fracking in the Marcellus Shale, as well as other shale formations, is in itself highly dangerous because it releases radioactivity. which is radon, as we know it. So how can you address that as eventually a safe process when the very fracking itself is dangerous?
I'd like to ask Barbara and Joe if they have any additional information. I've seen the information on radon, but I've frankly never looked at any technical information on the level. And that would be one of the planning issues you'd have to address.
Barbara, do you have anything?
Yes, the Marcellus Shale is located by its radioactivity. So it is a radioactive layer, and it's not just radon. There is alpha and beta radon radioactivity, which includes radon, which is a breakdown product of radium and also uranium in the Marcellus Shale. It accumulates in the scale, which is the corrosion material in the piping and as the natural gas and the fluids go in and out of the well. It is an intrinsic part of the gas mining process. It accumulates at a considerable rate and usually is often not monitored. In the Barnett Shale in Fort Worth, considerable barrels, a barrel is 42 gallons, of the material have been accumulated, and it is extremely toxic. And it is, if you want to do this safely, you can't.
So that's my point. It
yes.
cannot be done safely,
right.
no matter what. Is that right? Is that right?
There is opinions about that, and to my mind, it is an intrinsically contaminating process.
Can I say one thing? I have a list. Carl Pope, who is the executive director of the National Sierra Club, is for drilling, even though the regional chapter is not. And I urge everybody to write to the national headquarters, which is in San Francisco, California, to tell them how you feel about that. Because apparently, according to the Aspen Institute survey, every member of Congress and key federal officials named the Sierra Club as the most influential environmental organization in Washington, D.C.
There are many possibilities of non-carbon sources of energy that must be explored. At the point where this type of destructive sourcing of energy is declared environmentally insanity, and the tremendous wealth of these companies is turned towards these non-carbon sources, they will be developed. You must demand them. This demand must come from the bottom up, just like the demand for protection of your environment must come from you. Damascus Citizens was formed in a little town in Pennsylvania. We are grassroots. We speak from our home. You must speak from your home. You must speak loudly. You must spread this information, and you must demand what you want.
Yeah. Oh. Yes.
I just want to make a little announcement. Damascus Citizens has a series of CD and DVD set. It's a DVD, a video from Hickory, Pennsylvania, and an audio of 28-minute Theo Coburn talking about 2BE, an audio of testimonials from Hickory, Pennsylvania, and a disc of Josh Fox interviewed on WJFF. There's a clipboard with, you can sign up for getting these a set of these discs for whatever you want to donate. Some of it will be posted on the website in this area, but if you don't have access to a computer and you want to sign up to get them, or if you can help with the duplicating, the gentleman in the blue shirt back there has a clipboard, two of them, where you can sign up, and also a lady in red there. Please sign up, and you can get this information. Next question.
I've been told that there's right now a de facto moratorium on drilling in the Marcellus Shale in New York State. I was wondering if any of you guys could just clear up exactly what the legal processes would have to be for drilling in the Marcellus to actually start happening. I'm just a little confused as to that.
The moratorium is being held because under New York State law, you would have to do an EIS of essentially hydrofracking drilling because the issue has never been studied in the environment. So the state is doing kind of this generic statewide EIS of the whole process. The state has announced that once that process is completed, and they seem to be hurrying through the process in ways which I'm hopeful and actually reasonably confident will make enough mistakes so that they can be sued and then go down. But once that process is completed, then the state will be free to permit. Now, they will have to, on local sites, do, in many instances, supplemental EIS programs. But they will be free, once that's done, to start, you know, essentially trying to push permits out the door. So this process should go at least to the fall, but after that, I mean, there are people who have whispered in my ear that the reason they're pushing so fast instead of going so slowly is they want to get this issue behind them before next year's election. I have no idea whether that's true or not, but I've seen stranger things.
5 more minutes, folks.
The other part of that is if you sign a petition and you get a hearing statement, a hearing set up, you buy yourselves 2 more months, and then they could actually be changes in the supplemental GIS. G-E-I-S? Okay. G-E-I-S, sorry. Next. Generic environmental impact statement.
If the drilling has started in Van Etten, right?
Not into the Marcellus. Into a different formation.
There's several formations. That's what that slide was with the different colors. The supplemental generic environmental impact statement, the draft of which is being prepared, is only reference to the Marcellus Shale. They are currently drilling into the Herkimer and other layers. Yes. Some, yes. Some fracking, yes.
Oh. Well, I was just going to ask, under the mistaken impression that that the drilling had already started in Van Etten, if anyone had a sense of when this would start in Tompkins County, but nothing will be done before the GEI?
In order to not incur doing a site-specific environmental impact statement, they're waiting until the generic statement is done. Otherwise, they're obligated to do a site-specific statement. So it's cheaper to just wait in that respect. But they are also going into other formations.
Okay, thank you.
Good evening. I want to thank you also for speaking. And one of the things that I saw tonight in your presentation actually gave me a lot of hope, and that is the map showing the watershed, the New York City watershed, as well as the southern tier. And I strongly believe that working together will save us, but we have to do that. My question to you is, I'm very concerned about the leases that have been put out, people who signed the leases who now know how dangerous and how bad this is. Is there any way they can get out of their leases? Because I see a lot of hope in that. There's got to be a way to do that, because I feel like they've been put into this in a very false precinct.
There's the ideal situation. There's some growing interest in doing something about this. Politically, it may be one other thing, is to essentially allow a cooling off period. And, you know, like, for example, in I'm thinking there's a very good example of that, unfortunately, I'm blanking, and say that they believe that the conditions of the lease were fraudulently misrepresented. And if that's the case, and there's certainly a bunch of opportunities to prove that, although I wouldn't want to comment on any specific situation, the attorney, until legislation is passed, the attorney general is the right place to go. I mean, you can go through the civil courts, but you think you're better off getting somebody who will put some muscle behind this and look for a generic solution, not just one individual, helping one individual.
Because I see a lot of hope in that and a lot of power in that, because if we can stop it by doing that, then that'll echo into a mobilization effort, and it could really turn a lot of things around.
Well, I think every example of the unfairness and the externalization of the current system makes the case for either changing it or putting this whole issue aside until someone does decide to change it. But my advice to those who feel they're in that situation now and who believe they can honestly say they misunderstood or misrepresented the situation, I think they should go to the Attorney General.
I'd like to address the first part of your statement, and that is that what New York City might be doing related to the New York City water supply system. We formed a group in New York just recently in New York City called NYH2O, and they're dedicated to protecting the water statewide. And as a consequence of gas drilling very specifically. Just recently, we made a presentation to Community Board 2, that's on the West Village of New York, and Community Board 2 passed a referendum which bans drilling in the state, drilling statewide. And the goal of New York H2O right now is to bring that resolution to all 59 community boards. That's in the works right now. We have a lot of legs on the ground in New York City. If that goes to 59 community boards, and it's very likely because New York City doesn't have anything to gain by the Marcellus and everything to lose, we've got 8 million New Yorkers, which represent half the state, that goes to the governor.
Just a quick point on the lady that just made mention of that. 2 years ago, the Attorney General's office came to Erin. They took 25 complaints, all they could handle at that time. They came back and did 25 more. They've been to Vinette. If you would contact the Attorney General's office, they will send two attorneys to your town. What you need to do is get a group together of at least 15, 20 people complaining at one time. He will come.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks, Tim. Okay. Thank you to all of you for coming out. And in particular, thank you to Barbara Arendelle and Joe Levine and Al Appleton. I think we all owe them a round of applause. They truly acted selflessly in coming out here today to share what they know with all of us. And I, for one, sincerely appreciate it. There will be another forum on May 6th at the Women's Community Building, as I mentioned earlier. On the subject, what can towns do? I also want to thank the sponsors of this forum, Social Ventures, Catholic Charities of Tompkins County, CRESP Center for Transformative Action, Sustainable Tompkins, Ithaca Health Alliance, Back to Democracy, Shale Shock Citizens Coalition, Department of City and Regional Planning of Cornell University, and Assemblywoman Barbara Lifton. And finally, I would like to thank the four women who organized this event, which was no small feat. It didn't just happen. And those four women are Lisa Ann Wright, Risa Sokolowski, Candy Mingan-Stoshek, and Sarah Hess. Thank you.
You've been listening to a forum, Natural Gas Drilling, Health Effects, Economics, and the Watershed, held in Ithaca, New York, on March 26, 2009. For more information and to get involved, visit shaleshock.org. To download a copy of this program, visit unwelcomeguests.org.
Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always